for 1 hour or half an hour. So I spoke. And they asked me, why did you do this? Why did you stick up these posters? I said, I didn't stick up these posters and distribute these leaflets with the hope that by doing so, I would resurrect National Socialism and make it the ruling force in Germany and in this world. Certainly not. That job is much too great for a single individual. It's the job of the gods. They'll do it in time if it's their sweet pleasure. Personally, I did it for 3 reasons. First, I obeyed my conscience. Didn't you tell them in Nuremberg, didn't you tell the world in Nuremberg that a man has to follow his conscience? Of course, you said the world conscience. My conscience is not the world conscience, it's a private conscience. But I follow that. I don't know what the world conscience is. According to me, it doesn't exist. So I followed my conscience. It told me to do this, and I did it. Second, I wanted to show the German people at the time of humiliation and martyrdom that at least there were some individuals on the surface of the earth that were still for them. And third, I wanted to defy not only you, the occupation powers, but all those that were against us. I wanted to show them that the easy task, that is to say, drowning a whole continent in fire and phosphorus, killing millions of people, 5 million civilians were killed in Germany alone. That it was an easy task, and they did it. It was so easy, with ample Jewish money and technique put in service of a cause that was theirs. But the difficult task they couldn't do and cannot do. This is a very difficult task being to denazify, as they say, one person. Not many, one. And not a man at that, but nothing but a woman. And not a German woman at that, but a woman from the other end of the earth. They cannot do that. They could kill me if they liked. They didn't do it well. It's the affair. But they could. They can't denazify me. That's what I want to show. They can neither denazify me, nor can they denazify the natural forces. The principles of National Socialism, based on cosmic laws, will still be true. Wherever they are, we are in the universe, on this planet or on other planets, whatever they do. And that's what I wanted to say, that's all. And I started quoting something from Mein Kampf, and the judge stopped me. The quotation was, the only thing that should prompt our action is neither the approval nor the reprobation of the people around us, but only our allegiance to the truth in which we believe. I didn't say it in whole, I said a part of it only. And the judge interrupted me, he said, I don't want to know what your Führer wrote. I said, I'm sorry, because it's because he wrote things like that I'm here. I acted according to his writings. Anyhow, I went away. The trial was over, he said, 3 years. 3 years, rigorous imprisonment. I thought to myself, these people don't really love that blessed democracy. Because if I had been caught in the Russian zone, it would not be 3 years rigorous imprisonment. It would have been 30 years in a Siberian camp. And I would be dead by now, long ago. But the communists have a faith, a false one, but a faith. And they can understand people who have a different faith. And they can understand them, and they know that any person who has a faith is dangerous, potentially at least, to all those who hate that faith. These people don't feel the same. Their first concern is their bread and butter and their enjoyment. Democracy gives them that, all right, long live democracy. If we gave them that, if we came to power tomorrow and gave them the same thing, they'd say, Heil Hitler, so many did in Germany before the catastrophe. So many did of that description. And they say the contrary now. Those are the Democrats. Those are the Western anti-communists. And they will be crushed by the communists, because the communists have a faith and they have none, unless we crush the communists. We are the only ones. We have seen that in Vietnam. Anyhow, that was long after these happenings. I went out. I had taken with me my swastika earrings, brought in India, great big filigrane earrings of gold. As soon as the sentence was given, and I feared no more, there was no talk to be a neck and then a future, I mean, say, a continual next trial because of my earrings, I put them on. I stood up, I did the Hitler salute, looking at the people, and I walked off. Some people of the press wanted to interview me, but the authorities didn't allow it. One thing I can say, the two rows of Jews that were at the first places, they were not laughing any longer. I don't suppose I frightened them, I was not such a powerful person, but they felt the spirit. They felt this can always begin again. As long as there are people who really are given to it, it can begin again. That's what they seemed to think. They didn't tell me so. I don't know what they thought. I can't read people's thoughts. But that's what it seemed to me. I walked off. And I was taken to hell after that. That was my trial in Düsseldorf, Müllerstrasse, on the 5th of April, 1949. Exactly 2 years after my watch of fire on the banks of the, on the flanks of the burning Hekla in Iceland. Exactly 2 years. And now, what do you want to know?
Okay.
Well, I already knew Mr. Jordan and Mr. Tindall and the other members of the NSM. NSM existed since 1961 or 62. Even before, I think it might have existed, but I was in England in 61 for the Easter holidays, and it was not yet the NSM. There was some other organization headed by Monsieur Fontaine. And Jordan, I don't know whether he was in it or not. Anyhow, Jordan came to prominence after his great speech in Trafalgar Square in July. I think it's 50, it might have been 61. Yes, it was 61, July 61. And the foundation of the NSM and the growth of it. And then I met François Dior in 62. Jordan was in correspondence with me, and he gave me her address and asked me to meet her. And then in 62, I came over to England again. This was in July, as far as I remember. I put up in London at my friend's, Miss Gentry, perfectly apolitical woman, very pleasant and very understandable. She never spoke a word against us. She's perfectly apolitical, sympathetic, I would say. And I put up with her. And she told me, look here, you came to go to the Kostfeld camp. I know you have an international Hitler camp, and you want to go. If I were you, I would not go, because look what's in the papers. And she showed me a newspaper. And the papers said, this camp, any foreigner that goes to it, will not set foot in England again, she said. Isn't it a pity? You have so many friends here. You want to see them again. You want to be in touch with them. Look at the risk you are taking. With my natural spirit of defiance, I answered, it doesn't matter. I'll take the risk. I'm always ready to take a risk for these kind of things. And I went. We had an interview, I mean, say we had a meeting at the NSM in Holland Park, and we went to the station in separate groups. We were to meet somewhere else. We were to meet at, what was the correct place? Cheltenham. And from Cheltenham, a car was to take us to the camp. All right, we were troubled all night, and we let it settle down. All night, and I don't remember, yes, we went at night. We were in Chetlham part of the day, and at night again, we went to a place without knowing, I didn't know where we were going. I couldn't have found the camp again. We landed in the camp. There were tents, and we occupied each one a tent, or sometimes two or three in the same tent. I was sharing my tent with a Belgian lady, whose son was in the movement. Her son was with some boys. And I remember the awakening the next morning. It was Tyndall's voice coming from a tent, and he was speaking of I don't remember who. He said, "What? They're in bed still? Kick them out. Fancy staying in bed all this time till 8 o'clock, like bloody Democrats." When I heard that, I thought to myself, but I'm in bed still. I must get up quick, quick, quick. So I got up, and I went to the river as soon as I possibly could. I got there, but it was practically, there was actually nobody there. And I started bathing in the river. It was freezing cold water. I didn't want to be called a bloody Democrat or acting like one. And I said to myself, oh, they came and offered me hot water, tepid water. I said, no, thank you, I bathe in cold. So I bathed in the freezing cold water, which was in the summer, of course. I don't know if I would have done it in winter, but in summer it was quite all right. And I came out and I went up and we had breakfast. We had tea. I didn't like tea myself, but I took tea all the same. There was nothing else, there was no coffee. And the camp started. Contacts with different people. There were Swedes, there were Germans, of course, good majority of Germans. There were one or two Italians, one or two Frenchmen, some Belgians, and one or two Americans. One or two Americans, one named Harry May. This Harry May had a swastika brassa on his right arm. He was the only one to wear one. And he showed himself extremely sympathetic and ran after me, was always to talk to me. There were others too, but I didn't want to talk always to Harry May, but he really wanted to talk to me. I thought he was all right. I thought he was, I didn't know. Anyhow, it went the first day, second day, third day. And one day, there was a surprise come waiting for us. They told us there was a surprise. They said, be ready, sit on your benches, and you're going to have a surprise. Of course, I was surprised before that to see that Tyndall had vanished. And Jordan was not there. So I was wondering why. And they said to us, they'll come later. Actually, on that day, it was the 4th of August, or was the 3rd, I don't remember. It was very short after the beginning of the camp. There was a hospice lead plate. There were lights all over the place. It was in the forest. And suddenly coming up from the river, I saw Rockwell, Tyndall one side of him, Jordan the other side of him. And we all stood up, stretched out our arms, and the hospice lead was played. And we were so pleased to see Rockwell. It was written in all the papers, this man shall not come to England. He was absolutely unwanted by the government, by the system. And then the next day we saw in the papers, this man is in England. And he was here. He gave us a speech on that very night. A speech that lasted practically, well, not all night, but with the questions it practically lasted all night. It was the first time I saw Rockwell. I was really thrilled. He was a great personality. But from what he told us on that very night, I felt, poor Rockwell, I wouldn't like to be in his place. Why? Because he became conscious of the value and truth of National Socialism after the war. And after he had fought the war so well on the American side as to get reward, decorations and whatnot, he was a very good soldier. And I wouldn't have liked to be in his place. Have fought National Socialism all these years. And then when the war is finished, and when the other side has won, to find out that it was the truth. Find out that he has fought the truth. Fought against the truth. Really, I wouldn't like to be in this place. I'd rather be a little nobody, which I am. But I liked him for his sincerity and for his courage. It needs courage to say, I was wrong. And especially when one has such a great reputation as he had, decorations and whatnot. He could have kept quiet. He did not keep quiet because he knew that the truth was the truth and one has to stick up for it. And he told us all about his own history. It was after the way he had seen the reaction of the average American to MacArthur and to his policy that he had made an inquiry and found that National Socialism was right. And then he founded and organized this American Nazi Party, which is called today National Socialist White People's Party, NSWPP. It's not the only movement in America, but it is one of the movements, the main movement. There are two or three other little small groups. At the time, I had been in touch with several of the members of the National Socialist Party of America. Among others, one Dan Burris. I had been in correspondence with him from India. He used to write enthusiastic letters. And suddenly he stopped. So I asked Rockwell, what happened to Dan Burris? And the answer of Rockwell struck me and made me admire Rockwell all the more. He said, I kicked him out, that one. I said, why did you kick him out? What has he done? Well, I caught him half strangling a poor dog. And I don't want cowards in the National Socialist Movement. To hurt an animal is to be a coward, especially a faithful, trusting dog. So I kicked him out. That, I thought to myself, that is something that the Führer himself could have done. I don't know whether he ever did it, he had the opportunity of doing it, but he could have done that. And it was the first time that I ever heard of a political party leader, a man that depends on public opinion to have a following, kick a man out of his party because that man has shown cruelty to an animal. I found that very good. I said, bravo, Rockwell, and you did the right thing. If that's the fact that you did the right thing. And I was to find out more about that famous Dan Burris a few years later in Montbrison, where I was working in France as a stopgap teacher. There was a newspaper on the table one morning I saw when I came down to get my coffee, take my morning coffee. And in that paper there was a few lines. A man called Dan Burris has been found dead in New York, in his room. He killed himself. And it is presumed that he killed himself, committed suicide, after an article had been printed in the New York papers saying that he, although a member of the National Socialist Party, was in reality a Jew. So I was fixed on Dan Burris. That's all. So, now more about Rockwell. I read his book, Tomorrow the World, his biography. There were passages in it that I liked very much. And there were passages I didn't like so much. The passages I didn't like so much were those about his wives, his children, he could have mentioned the whole lot in a few lines. I didn't see the necessity of talking so long about his private attachment to his first wife and then why he separated from her, and then his second one, it was a beautiful Icelandic girl. All right. In fact, the beautiful Icelandic girl left him when she gave him to choose between the movement and herself, and he chose the movement. Good for him. But why? Why not stick to him all the same, in spite of all the inconveniences? I find that not very good for a Nordic woman. Leave him for that. She's left him, and the children are in with her in Iceland. Anyhow, that's the only thing I would say that was not absolutely within my expectations of his book. The book, in spite, is quite all right. Very good book. And I went on in Cotswolds. I met, of course, Tyndall. I saw The Birth of the Prince, the WUNS, founded by Rockwell. Rockwell was the first head of it, and by Tyndall, and by Jordan, and by all the heads of the parties that were there. Of course, I joined it. And then I went to London, sent by the others, to pick up some American comrades, an American comrade and his wife. And I found them at the airport, and they went to the hotel, and it was said that we'll go next morning to the camp. I knew how to go to the camp by now. But next morning they showed me the papers. The camp has been broken up. Oh, I said, hear me. The camp has been broken up, so what to do? He said, well, it's no good going. You don't go yourself, you'll only be getting yourself into trouble. I said, but I've left my things there. I've left my suitcase and all my things. I must collect that. So I went, in spite of all, I went back to the camp. The camp was in a turmoil, but my things were there. I said, all right, I'm going to collect them. But to my astonishment, the police was there also. And the police took the passports of everyone. And I asked Jordan, I said, should I give my passport? He said, well, I can't tell you to withdraw giving it, not give it, because you have a foreign passport. Yes, of course, I had a Greek passport. Not an Indian one any longer, because the Indian didn't want to renew it. But I had to have a passport, so I took a Greek one, I took my old Greek one back again. The police saw it, put some stamp on it, that I was not to come back to England again. And from that day, I tried four times to land in England again, and I was repelled every time. I was sent back. I tried by plane, I tried by boat, I tried every way. I was sent back. And it was all the more vexing because I was publishing a book in England at that time. Long Whiskers and the Two-Legged Goddess, a book about cats, but not only about cats. The undertitle of it is The True Story of a Most Objectionable Nazi and Half a Dozen Cats. That's nine beautiful cat pictures in it. It exists, but of course I would have liked to have 1,500 copies. I was never given sent more than 270 copies. I distributed a few. I had another 100, perhaps 150 in France with my other books. When I left India, I had to leave them somewhere. I couldn't take all that by plane. And the friend in whose house I left it died. Her husband died also. And her two daughters just burnt the lot. Not only those books, but other books of mine, and the last of my doctorate thesis, and some books that I valued very much, because the people who had given them to me are now dead. One of these books was a book that was presented to me by Frau Himmler, Himmler's widow. It's burnt. And other books. They only gave me one or two books, Universal History and Asiatic Mythology, one or two books that a friend of mine collected. and sent over to me. And he was told, we burnt the whole lot. They were either non-interesting or even horrible books. That's what they were, I was told. Horrible books. So, now let's talk of something else. Let's talk of Harry May. Harry May disappeared. He disappeared. Nobody knew what he was. He stayed one day or two. And I went and asked Rockwell. I said, what's happened to this man, Harry May? What's his name, Harry May? Oh, he said, you mean Harry May, that communist. I said, how did he come here? I said, why did he come here? Why did he wear a swastika on his arm? He said, well, he came to see you. And he vanished. I heard of him again. He wrote to me a letter from USA at my address. I had given him my address in all confidence. I never wrote again, naturally. And I was told that he had been very glad to see me, but that, of course, his ideas were not those of the NSF. But I could understand that his ideas were different since Rockwell himself told me he was on the other side. And I regretted very much that I gave him gold in the fun. No, I gave him the lightning and the sun. And I saw that the copy I had given, he had underlined so many things, he had taken notes and this and that, so thoroughly, I could hardly understand why. I said, my book is not so important as to underline all these things. Apparently, he considered it worth underlining. And he sent me a nasty book of Wilhelm Reich, a dirty Jew that writes about sex. I never was interested in sex. It's a chapter that has no place in my life at all. Why did he send me that dirty book? I don't know. Of course, the dirty book I threw away. I didn't even take the trouble wasting my eyesight to read it. And that was that. But why did he send it to me? That made me even more, well, how can I say, even more suspicious. And I found out, well, there was one good thing in the fact of him sending me that book. It meant that he lacked complete psychology. Because I'm the last person to send such a book to. Therefore, he did not have any knowledge of what I am. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. It means a communist without any psychology is not such a dangerous communist as one with psychology. That's Now, let us talk about Jordan and Tinder. I liked them very much, both of them. And my great regret is that they are not together still. I liked them very much. And Jordan introduced me to Françoise Dior, former Countess of Caumont-la-Force. Her first husband was a member of one of the oldest French families, nobleman. And she had by him a daughter that must be now 20. She was born on the 4th of November, I think 20 years ago. Now, Françoise Dior was born in 1932, on the 7th of April. And she grew up, that is to say, under the German occupation. And she had some very nice memories from that. She must have been beautiful as a child. She is a beautiful woman today. But she must have been very beautiful also as a child. And she remembers, one of her sweetest remembrances, she showed me, was the caress on her blonde hair of an SS man's hand, saying, what a beautiful little Aryan girl. She was about 8 or 10. She remembers that. And of course, that didn't impress her, that didn't over-impress her, that she didn't link this with any ideology at the time. And her great love was French nobility, old France, France before the revolution of 1789. And I quite understand her. Personally, I always was against the French Revolution of 1789. I too was a royalist when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. different kind of royalist, but I mean, say royalist in favor of the king of Greece, but it was the same thing. I was a royalist to begin, and so was she. And her dream was to marry into French nobility because it was nobility. She believed in nobility. Until she had great disappointments with it. She married a man that was not, well, what we would call the model. Private life was anything but the model of a Venerian, and of an Venerian of noble family on the top of that. She put up with him for some time, and then she had to divorce. She took the child, she divorced. And slowly, it dawned on to her that real nobility was not a title, but real nobility was a nobility of blood. If you have the blood and the title, all right, but in that case, your title must give you the feeling that you have to live up to it. You can't have any sort of private life with a title. But she was already, I would say, she was already in that milieu, in that movement, and it was very difficult for her to pull herself out and to live up to the austerity of a real National Socialist. She feels National Socialist, of course, but many times I've told her about the needed austerity of everyday life, if one is such one. She tries to live up to it. At least she tried. I don't